Hi, I'm Ken Sweeney. This is The Comfortable Spot. Welcome. Today, my guest is Shashati Basu. Shashati is an award-winning journalist, editor, and podcast host with over 10 years' experience working with various prestigious online and print media organizations. Shashati is also a strong advocate for women and disabled rights and has been involved in this field via work with numerous human rights organizations across the world. Her podcast, How to Be, is hugely informative and through its conversations with expert guests acts as a lighthouse for those who are seeking help and advice for the many problems that life throws at us today. There is an honesty throughout the entire podcast, with the listener being the focus, and the lack of hard sell tactics is refreshing. It was a real pleasure chatting with Shashati about her many achievements. So I hope you're sitting comfortably and happy to stay with us. Shashati, how are you? Welcome to The Comfortable Spot.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It's been brilliant because we know each other quite well via, you know, social media. We're kind of to and fro on whether it be arguments, you know, following arguments that are going on somewhere else, or, you know, talking about the how the new Batman movie is just kind of falling flat in its face.
Hilarious, yeah. Yes.
But of course, the other thing is that you are very prominent in the podcasting world with your brilliant podcast, How to Be. You're also a journalist. You've been writing for a number of the leading platforms in the UK. The Guardian, I think you've written for a couple of articles. I've chased you down on that one. Mm-hmm. And you're currently still working in journalism as well. So I wanted to just start off, because let's get straight into this, because we've got so much to talk about. Your path towards media and journalism. As a young lady, did you say to yourself, I want to be a writer or a journalist? Was that something that you always wanted to do?
Yeah. Do you know, it's actually really strange because it was almost subconsciously because I found much older, when I was about 11 or 12 years old, like a folder that I was given at the end of school from a teacher who said, I hope you become a journalist one day and you get to live in China. And that's exactly what ended up happening.
Wow.
So subconsciously, I was always working my way through it and I had no idea I was doing it.
Mm. And you said there, China. Did you go and work in China for a while?
Yeah, I lived in China for 4 years and I studied Mandarin as my degree. So I studied also in China and I worked on as a journalist in on Chinese publications over there and also English ones.
Incredible. And like, how do you get your head around the fact that you're going to such an alien environment? And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a fair way. It's quite different to how we live our lives here in the UK and Ireland. So what was the first thing that gripped you when you went there that said, oh, wow, this is really different. I need to kind of, you know, find out how this works.
Do you know, it's weird because I think with my South Asian sort of heritage, it wasn't so out of my comfort zone because I spent like the first 6 years of my life, like in India, where, you know, we were just in a very different environment. So, you know, sometimes there was running water, sometimes there wasn't, you know, and it was just sort of like, I was kind of used to having that different kind of culture always surrounding me. Which kind of prepared me for, first of all, different languages, which was really helpful. Having all those different languages, like growing up with different languages, helped me really set me up for other ones. And then by the time I got to China, I just found the people absolutely lovely. And they were so similar to some of the people back in India that I just kind of fit right in. So I used to have great conversations with these, you know, just sitting in a shop, sit there for hours with people, just chatting. Really lovely people. It's a difficult life though there. It's not an easy life. It's sort of like living standards are at about 1970s UK. So, you know, life is hard and you really do have to toil to get anywhere there. But it was such a remarkable experience being there.
Do you think that in terms of, say, the way the media is controlled in China, obviously you believe in free speech and all the other elements, the basic elements that come with journalism, but what do you think about that when you look back on, say, your time there? Was there any restrictions that you might have come up against and said, oh God?
Yeah, there were some major ones. For one, I was really keen at one point when I was living in Shanghai, I was really keen on sort of exploring the LGBTQIA scene over there, which is huge. And that was absolutely frowned upon. Could not talk about it, even though it was very open in many respects. There was a whole sort of area, a whole sort of quarter, a bit like we have down in London, you know, Soho or things like that. But for some reason, no one wanted to talk about it, which I thought was really sad. And so that there was one aspect like that. And then in the end, I actually had to leave China because I was reporting on, say, prostitution in Beijing. And I was contacting NGOs and things like that. And I saw that they put like a red flag on my emails. So I had to leave the country just in case. Things got a bit more dicey.
Yeah, that was a brave move, though, you know, because sometimes people can get lazy and say, okay, this is a good life. I'm kind of a, you know, this European in China, and I'm kind of got a stature that I'm very happy with. But to take that step and say, okay, well, I'm not happy with what I see here, and I'm going to report on that. It's a difficult choice, but it's a brave choice that you made. And it always seems, does that always seem to be your path in terms of human rights and when, you know, and equal opportunities and, you know, dealing with minority groups and all? Is that where you see yourself when you look at journalism?
Yeah, 100%. It's the only reason I really went into journalism in the first place, which was just giving a platform to those people who don't have voices. And so hence, I would always pursue those difficult stories, even though it meant that I was always on the other end of it. You know, it was difficult from time to time, get a lot of trolling and things like that. But, you know, it was like, if I don't say the story, who will? And, you know, especially if they don't have a platform to speak. So it was really important for me to just kind of hold my nerve and just try and give as much out really in the sphere of journalism in this respect. So yes, it was difficult, but yes, it was worth it.
Yeah, and maybe we can actually talk about something that's very close to your heart, and that's you know, disabled rights, because you suffer from a condition, HNPP. And before we go into that, could I ask you about that condition? What exactly does it entail, and how difficult can it be?
Yeah, it's extremely rare condition. So mm-hmm. It stands for hereditary neuropathy with liability to pressure palsies. And maybe the closest thing that people would really understand it to is it's very similar to MS. So essentially you get this sort of what you call like a sheath, a cover around your nerves. And like MS, it's degenerating. So I have exactly the same symptoms of MS, but just coming through a genetic form. So that's why I will suffer exactly the same symptoms, including, you know, just paralysis from time to time. I will have quite serious bouts of nerve seizures and things like that. So it's, it can be very debilitating. And as a result, I haven't got full function of my arms and legs. So it is pretty intense, and it is degenerative. So you just kind of you've got to make the most of it, really.
Do you have good days and bad days with this?
100%. It is extremely, you know, it can even be hour to hour. It can change very sporadically depending on my energy levels. If my energy drops, I could end up having a seizure. So it can be really sort of sporadic, and you have to be extremely sort of mindful of your condition as you're going through the day.
And about treatment, let's look at maybe different paths in that. Do you think that there is a, you know, your mindfulness, because you know, you have a focus on that a lot within your podcast and about well-being and, you know, being right in the head, as we say here in Ireland. Do you think that helps?
100%. You know, I think with a lot of conditions, especially nowadays, you know, I think people don't really understand the impact of stress on people's bodies. It is very visceral. And I have a secondary condition called functional neurological disorder, mm-hmm. which basically is completely stress-based. I can become paralyzed and have seizures just through stress. So that's extremely important. And it is, people thought it was a psychological condition at one point,
right.
But then what they found was that when they did a CAT scan, an MRI, they noticed that the brain was actually changing. It had changed its pathways. So it is actually a neurological condition. So, you know, it is quite incredible what, you know, mental health can do to your physical health. So that's why I'm very sort of keen on exploring that subject generally. And so, you know, I'm kind of hoping that people are much, much more sort of aware of being sort of kind to themselves.
I mean, it's amazing that you say that, because we seem to have a different type of stress in this world now. Like, for example, if you go back to, say, from ancient times right up to maybe the 19th century, stress was usually physically related, whether it be in terms of starvation, war, pestilence, and so on, you know, and just trying to survive on a daily basis, whether you could get killed, you know, attacked or raped, whatever. So these were the stresses that the human body had to endure. And come, you know, say the 17th and 18th century, we were beginning to, you know, tick the boxes in removing those types of stresses. But stress nowadays seems to be completely different. It seems to be based on, you know, pressure on the brain rather than pressure on the body. We have comfortable lives. We have nice couches. We can go and shop in IKEA, or we can, you know, buy from the artisan shop. But, you know, you take, for example, my complete gripe in life is how these large social media companies work. You go in there and it's like they've got cushy sofas and they've got little chill out rooms and, you know, it's a basketball court in the middle of the thing. But it's all designed to keep you there. It's not designed to switch you off. There's no bell that rings that says, oh, it's 5:30, let's go home, clock out. And, you know, this is, then you get to say 35 in those buildings, or sorry, in those companies, and they're looking at you strange and they're saying, you know, you haven't had a, you know, a promotion. We're wondering what your path to your future is. And, you know, really what they want to do is they don't want 55-year-old men and women or anybody working in those organizations, because they have commitments, they have obligations, they have physical requirements that they didn't have when they were 20. And I think those are the pressure that people are suffering nowadays. And I don't, you more probably know more about this. Is it that case that with these type of pressures that we're going to see more neurological issues with people going forward?
Yeah, I 100% agree, because I think people don't really understand what trauma is, and it can affect you in so many different ways, and it doesn't have to be, say, physical or any other kind of abuse. It can also be this level of trauma, which is losing a job, really kind of sort of, you know, even things like divorce and things, and people don't really understand the impact it can have on a person. And, you know, our reptilian brain is still always with us, which means the fight, flight, freeze mode. It just stays with us, you know, from our primitive eras. So, you know, we are going to always have this same reaction to most of these things, which means, yes, we will probably end up with lots of neurological issues as a result. But again, I'm not a doctor, so obviously... Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we're just conversing here about from experience. Yeah. I mean, for example, my daughter has a podcast and she's 9 years of age and she is on YouTube now, and she looks at all of these other podcasters and, you know, all of these other YouTube presenters. And then she said to me last week, which I really, it struck a chord in me and I had to be weary of it. She said to me, oh, I'm watching this lady. She talks about, you know, doing artistic designs and stuff like that. And I says, yeah. He said, do you know she's a millionaire? And I was like, we're at that point now where she's found something, or the lady has said something. And, you know, I said to her, look, you know, YouTube, I said, you know, they're a very small amount of people. Don't think of it as an easy path. But this is the thing, isn't it? Because nowadays with modern society, you do have these people who have come across this get rich scheme where they have 6 million followers. And you're just like, you turn on YouTube and I look at some people, they're always the same faces using the same images. And, you know, they're just nonsense podcasts where they look at people falling. And yet they've 7 million followers. And you're kind of saying to yourself, this is not the way we should be. Whereas we have podcasts like yours, right? Where you're just trying to bring people into a circle of well-being, where you're trying you're trying to encourage, and you're not preaching to them. And that's the thing. And we can probably start talking about your podcast now. But in your podcast, How to Be, you're the one who's just kind of facilitating this open door policy. It's like when I listen to your podcast, I feel like I've been invited to a kind of a gathering of, you know, minds who are just not out to sell anything or to kind of tell you they're, you know, your 5 points to success. You know, all these silly American get rich quick scams. I don't feel I'm being scammed on your podcast. So,
gosh, I'm glad.
You know, and it's true, because sometimes you can, because, you know, there's always a hook at the end, you know, especially with, say, when you listen to American podcasts, there's always a hook at the end. You know, you have those guests who, and they contact me as well on my podcast, where they say, I used to be an alcoholic for 25 years and then, you know, I discovered God, or I came across this way and I did.
I'm so tired of those.
It's just self-importance. It's kind of like you kind of sit there and you're saying to yourself, this is all about you. I'm sorry, I'm not interested in that.
100%.
And although my podcast is all about the guest, as in you, you're not that type of person anyway. You're sitting there and you're going, okay, this is, you know that this, my guest today is an expert in this field, and he knows exactly what he's talking about, and I want you to spend 10 minutes, not 2 hours, just listening to him. And I love that. You know, it moves on the podcast. It doesn't stick with this kind of hour of repetitive kind of preaching. Was that something you always wanted to kind of get when you sat down with the podcast? Did you say, okay, 5 points or 6 points? I know we just discussed that there a second ago. Yeah. But when it comes to podcasting, this is relevant. So you had like 5, 6, 7 ideas and you wanted to make sure that they were included? Or did you just kind of let the podcast run and develop itself?
Yeah, I kind of let it develop, because basically the main focus was that I won't use my voice continuously. Because I hate speaking in public, it was really important for me to not be the focus on that podcast. And so generally it's not really my kind of style to do selfies or anything like that. It's just never been what I do. So you'll probably notice even on my social media, I don't have pictures of myself and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was always like very much on the agenda that I will not be the focus of this podcast. It just means I'm just using myself as almost like a vehicle to say, hey, you're not the only one. I'm also in this situation too. You know, if you have this problem, so do I. You know, so trying to make people feel a bit more like you're not alone. And I think that was really important for me. So I thought, okay, here's all these kind of basic skills in life that, you know, especially if you've grown up with sort of a lot of difficulties, it means that, you know, sometimes you just miss out on really important skills or important ideas or things like that. So, you know, given that I read quite a lot, it just made a lot of sense to kind of bring that information in and see if we can sort of dissect some of that information and make it a bit more palatable so we can all learn something from it. And then I was like, it shouldn't just be about the books. It should also be about people. Everyone has life experiences and it's all very different. And we should kind of include other people's opinions in it, which is why I just get random swathes of the community to just have their opinion about a subject as well. Because actually we can all learn from one another. And I think that was the basis, what ended up happening quite organically with it.
It's a lot of work as well. I mean, I listen to your podcast and I think, you're putting in hours. I mean, I'm not going to go into this because we all know in the podcasting world that, you know, it's not the hour that happens with the conversation. It's the other couple of hours, and it's the research, and it's the, the editing and all that kind of thing. It sounds like a Herculean task, but you seem to relish in it.
You're right. It is a very, very long process. It can take a week of just getting through interviews and editing and researching and reading, because I'm having to read at least 2 books a week. So it is a lot of work, but I find that there's something that gives me joy from it, which is like trying to produce something that might actually help someone out there, even if it's one person who just needed to hear that. Or, you know, so for example, it might be a bit strange that last week, for example, I touched on the subject about social media and whether it's harmful or not. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, someone out there might have been trolled, or someone out there might have really had a horrible experience and they might need to hear this, or maybe this is going to help them in terms of say, you know, we had a guest on who said she had been horrifically trolled because she was quite a big TV anchor in the US, and they found out that she'd been on Girls Gone Wild, and, you know, and she had a horrible time as a result. And so many young people who've gone through all those awful experiences of, you know, revenge situations, you know, these images of themselves, you know, they might be able to kind of resonate with what she said, for example. So, you know, even these small subjects that might not be directly linked to mental well-being, somehow everything is related.
It's kind of, you're telling me that story and it's horrific, you know, but that guest, And you kind of think, I'm thinking to myself, how can people be so cruel? You know, for sure, there are idiots in, you know, in all forms of life. And sometimes you need to say it to them. Sometimes you need to say, look, you're being an idiot. Shut up. You know, and you don't need to go with the knife. The knife doesn't have to go into the liver. You know, it has to be done in a spot on way and say, look, stop, you're being an idiot. This is just ridiculous. But people seem to go much further because they relish it, don't they? And when, especially on social media, they relish the anonymity of it. They can just do it without 100%. Consequences. Especially on with women. And, you know, what strikes me about it is that our modern culture, our modern social setup does not facilitate protection of women naturally.
No.
And also other minorities, because there's no need to mention all them because we know what they all are. And here's the thing. We know all about these situations. We know the abuse that women get. And yet so many men, they're not heroes in that sense. They kind of say, oh, that's life. You just have to deal with it. I'm kind of making sure that my daughters are aware of it. But they need to be saying more than aware. They need to be standing in front of them and saying it's not going to happen. You know, 100%. Saying I'm always there for you. And I think what happens is you have such a great element. For example, let's talk about Twitter. You have a great element of people on Twitter. So what I you know, if somebody, for example, announces that they have a problem or an issue or they're ill, the amount of support that they get generally is around 70 or 80% very positive. And that's a good thing, I think. And I think it tells the world that there are still a lot of really good people out there. The problem is that the bad people, the trolls, they do it on a professional level. I don't know why, but they do it like on a regular basis. So they're there. They seem to be in the focus more. But I think it's still a case where, you know, as you've spoken about social media a lot in your podcast. And I think what happens with social media is that you really do have to get a thick skin and just kind of say, it's not all bad.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. There is so much positivity, like on social media, you know, for example, fundraising for something really small, you know, that someone needs help, and there will always be people out there trying to assist. And that's great. And I think the problem is, it isn't the people itself, it's the companies that basically facilitate this kind of behavior, because they're getting rich essentially off that kind of trolling, because basically negative behavior is more lucrative than positive behavior. So, you know, that's why they don't do a fantastic job of removing bots and trolls and things like that, because at the end of the day, it inflates their kind of algorithms in terms of how much interaction people are having. So, you know, unfortunately, it's not always the people themselves. There's just this lack of responsibility from the top. And, you know, I've always been very much like, there shouldn't be anonymity on social media. Everyone should register with an ID. And that way, you know, we can have actual honest conversations, and we shouldn't be able to have bot farms for one.
Yeah. I agree 100%. And I think the problem is that they always throw this free speech and freedom of movement and freedom of do whatever you like sort of nonsense up in the flag. But at the end of the day, what we've done is we've caused a society that does cause problems for people on a psychological level and even a physical level. Do you know, it's funny you say that, because I listen to your podcast, and in your introduction, you describe yourself in your podcast as timid. And it's funny talking to you now, and obviously listening to all your podcasts and following you over, you know, the last couple of years, and then realizing that you've done over 65 episodes. I mean, you surely don't see yourself as timid anymore, because I don't see you timid at all.
Well, it's like a spectrum. So, for example, when I speak to someone one-on-one, like we're doing here, it's absolutely fine, because it feels like I'm just chatting to a friend. So it feels okay. Now, when I started the podcast, it was so, so terrifying that literally I was recording one sentence at a time. I was hyperventilating in between each sentence. So I had to, everything you hear in the first episode is literally a stitched up version of all my sentences, which is quite insane. But it improved, obviously, over time. And so I was able to say huge chunks and just kind of accept that I'd be making mistakes in between. So I was just talking and making mistakes, and that's fine. And then I was editing it out. But I realized that I'm still really nervous when I'm speaking. I'm wringing my hands under the desk as I'm speaking. And it's the same when I'm interviewing people. I'm wringing my hands. I could feel I'm just very tense, and I'm sweating absolutely profusely. And so all that fear is still very much there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just presented in a bit more acceptable way. So
it's funny because you're giving me examples of how you were feeling when you're doing certain things, and I'm sitting there nodding because I've done that. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there are people like that I've been interviewing over years, whatever it be, you know, and some interviews I've done where I felt I was being interviewed for a job. Yeah. You know, when you get that dreaded person that you have to speak to who asks you more questions than you ask them. So look, I sympathize with that. I think your behavior in those circumstances is perfectly normal. I've been offered to do talks and seminars and online Zoom chats for some of the work I do with this podcasting and with the organization, the European Network, and I say no all the time.
Yeah,
because I have an imposter syndrome in a lot of things. I kind of say to myself, why would they want to talk to me? I'm not that interesting. Mm. Or, you know, I don't know enough about it. And then, you know, it takes sometimes a stranger or maybe, you know, somebody close to you, but not very close, who's a bit honest, can say to you, no, you're fine. And like when I listen to your podcast, I mean, I actually do make a point, right? I love listening to the development of a podcast. So when I come across a podcast, the first thing I do is I always go to the first one. And I say okay, and then I go to the last one, and I like that helps me to get a gauge on the development of that podcast. You know, how much has the podcasters invested in the product? And if there's not much change between the first one and the last one, unless the content is really good, I tend to kind of veer away from it. And with your podcast, it just sounds perfect. I've listened to the first one, and I certainly did not in any way, shape, or form come across there, oh, that sounds like it's all broken up, or it sounds like it's very heavily edited. So fair play, you've done a good job in that respect, you know?
Thank God. Yeah. It was only 10 minutes long, which really helped, because obviously now they're up to about 40 minutes, which I still don't know how I've managed to do, but it started off at 10 minutes, so I think that's what I could manage at that time, like in terms of my stress levels. But, you know, by the end, I can manage 40 minutes, but it is really stressful. And Ken, I'm not sure if you're like me in that sense that I'm a social introvert, and I feel like, Ken, you're also similar, which is why we have those kind of, we don't want to talk to big crowds. We don't want to, you know, we've got imposter syndrome and all of that. So, you know, I think, you know, podcasting is really unique in that way, because us social introverts are actually quite okay on that platform because we're by ourselves just doing it. Having to branch out and talk to people, that's the scary bit.
It's funny, I get a lot of emails from people who contact me and say, your podcast's really good, how do you get loads of listeners? And I think, you know, it's, and I say to them, it doesn't matter how many listeners you get, because you're not really, you're doing it for to build listenership, but it's about you as well. And then one person contacted me before, and they said, I said this in another podcast, that they had about 150 people on their last podcast, and they were so disappointed. And I said to them, I said, why are you disappointed? And I said, imagine I said that those 150 people were in a room with you and they were saying to you all at once, we love your podcast. Imagine how that would feel, the impression that would give to you, you know, from a physical and, you know, an emotional point of view. So think about it that way. There's 150 people who have said, I listen to your podcast. And if you're getting an average between 100 and 150 people, that means they really like your podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's think this is the problem. I think people look at, going back to what we're saying about the YouTubers and all that, people look at 6.5 million viewers and you're kind of saying to yourself, oh, I can't even get 100. But it doesn't matter. 100's good. I think what we need to do is take a step back and say, look at it from a physical point of view. 100 people in a room is a big amount of people.
Yeah. And also, Ken, we need to stop gamifying every process. You know, it's, you know, we're all suffering from comparisonitis. And I think that is really harmful. You know, people should be proud of what they create. You know, being creative is the gift in itself. So, you know, I think it's a shame that people stop after like 4 episodes because they say, oh, well, I'm not getting enough listeners, because it shouldn't be about that.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of point of, you know, you reach that point 4 or 5 in. But I wanted to talk to you about your work in the feminist movement. And you're part of an organization, the Women and Girls Network. Could you tell me a little bit about that organization? Because I'm really fascinated by it.
Yeah, so I was in the Women and Girls Network from quite a young age. You know, I'm no longer part of it, but I actually supported it for many, many years. So I started off as an ambassador, a young ambassador for it. So I was about 18 years old. And then basically what I did was I would fundraise, I would go out and speak and basically support the organization in any way possible. Eventually I became an editor for their website to try and, you know, get their sort of funding okay and make sure that everything was up to date. And then basically that's how I left it. But I joined so many different feminist movements growing up, especially from 18 onwards. So London Feminist Network, Million Women Rise. And then obviously now I'm an ambassador and mentor at BEAT, which is the UK's national eating disorder charity, and also a trustee at Wheels for Wellbeing, which is a disability cycling charity. So it's always been part of who I am, I guess, to try and give service and volunteer as much as possible, because I feel like you aren't really a person if you aren't really supporting someone else, and you see yourself, if you always see yourself in a vacuum, then you won't really understand what your own sort of experiences are. It has to be sort of understood within a wider context. So it's, it's been a really big part of my life, which is to support other people.
Are we still in a place with regards to feminism where there is so much work to do?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's like always you have one win and then something goes backwards. It's just continuous. Like, so in when I first sort of started doing all my fundraising, and which was, again, many years ago, 2007 now, it was basically, you know, we were fighting for really different rights. So, for example, for my first year of uni, I was completely ostracized for being a feminist because it was still seen as a completely weird kind of thing. And then as the years were coming by and people started realizing, for example, violence and misogyny on campus and things like that, then they started realizing how feminism really plays into all of these different areas. So you've got more and more young people starting to get involved. So that's how, you know, I realized that I was part of a wave that was just before all of it really exploded for younger people. And so as it went on, it was fantastic to see younger people getting more involved in the movement, even when I left uni. And then basically we would have all these wins, you know, for example, we managed to stop, we stopped all beauty pageants coming into universities across the UK by creating a network. And we stopped, you know, for example, we were protesting outside of the Playboy store in London, basically stopped them from advertising products that were aimed at children, very sexualized products. So we got them removed. We stopped lads mags being put in the front of shelves. So that was all covered up. So, you know, we were doing small things all the time. But then, for example, you know, over COVID, you know, all these women lost their jobs. We had a massive economic crisis for women. They were all put back into the house. Then you had obviously huge violence against women, massive spike. And also you've had a number of very notable, horrific cases, including obviously Wayne Cousins, who murdered Sarah Everett. You had Sabina Nessa, who died on the street, you know, being attacked, you know. And unfortunately, it's like this, where we're winning one war, we're winning one battle, and then still going backwards. So it's a never-ending war, unfortunately.
The other thing is that there's levels of it. There's certain levels of hypocrisy that go in here. So you have, for a case, like, for example, last year there was a young Irish woman who was killed here. She was stabbed on a perfectly well-used pathway in a park in one of the smaller towns here in Ireland. And she was a white woman. And yeah, there was outcry. The entire country got behind this person's death, which is rightly so. But when it comes to other women, particularly women of colour or women who are non-nationals, and they have been murdered at home. And because they were murdered at home, maybe there wasn't such an outcry because the husband did it, you know? Whereas you have this combination of racism and white privilege and, you know, feminism being hit with misogynistic behaviour from men. It's just a mess.
It is.
What we need to do is we need to say, surely, and I'm asking you this, that women are women, regardless of where they come from, what their circumstances are, or how they died when they're being murdered. And murder is murder.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. But people have a very narrow mind when it comes to intersectionality. So for some reason, I think people really struggle with the idea that people have more than one identity. You know, they're like, okay, you're a woman, but you're just a woman, or you're a black or a brown woman, and you're just that. And they don't understand that the two sides of it coincide. Indeed. Oh gosh, sorry, I think my Alexa just went off.
Yeah, okay.
So it basically means that people who are brown women have a totally different experience to that of a brown man, black man, or a white woman. And so, unfortunately, they don't understand that this intersection creates a completely different experience. And so it's unfortunately seen as in the bottom of the pile in comparison to all of it. So, you know, we've had a number of situations. So Sabina Nessa's family said the same thing, where they felt that the police didn't react to it in time. Similarly, the nurse who recently went missing, I think her name was Owami. The police didn't react on time, even though she was a very vulnerable woman. You know, thank God she came out safe and alive. But it's unfortunately there is still that perspective and that very much some kind of bias and discrimination when it comes to women of color, because they are always seen as the other. And a very good example of this is this awful term called honor crime. There's no such thing as an honor crime. It's just a crime.
I exactly agree with you. Murder is murder. And
murder is murder.
Yeah. And, you know, this, as I said, you can add that level then of foreign nationals in countries. Mm-hmm. They're treated differently, because especially 100%. If they're alcoholic or, you know, mentally suffering husband does something to them, it's almost like they're trying to label an excuse on top of the guy for doing it. Oh, he was an alcoholic, or oh, he suffered from mental problems. You know, yeah. It's like, whatever the case, you can't demean the death.
No.
And the problem, the focus goes to the guy rather than the woman being killed.
Yeah, and you know how prevalent this is, especially in the US, where the murders, like the horrific mass shootings that happen, you know, the excuses that are made for the person who does it is just unbelievable. You know, when you have children dying, you know, you cannot use, oh, this is because of this. You know, there's a level of accountability that needs to be had with that individual. And I feel, unfortunately, because a lot of our authorities are still very much what you call sort of white men, it is very difficult to have a different perspective.
I wanted to ask you a point blank question, and I don't mind if you can't give me an answer on it. What does a man need to do to show his commitment to feminism and equality for women in society?
I think it's really important, one, first, to listen. Listen to the people that are going through these things. You know, it's very important. So first of all, listen. And second of all, then if someone is going through those things and going through a difficult period, understand how you can be a good advocate, not an ally, but an advocate. So understanding, okay, this person has behaved wrongly with this person. Now, I will ask my friend or whoever you are supporting, would you mind if I then speak to this person? Because I don't feel that was correct. You know, then definitely go ahead and, you know, make sure you speak to your male friends and say that this is not acceptable anymore. This is just not done anymore. Or, you know, I don't feel comfortable you speaking this way. Someone needs to step up and say it. Unfortunately, if usually in the case where a woman says it, either they are harassed, they can, you know, end up in a terrible situation where, you know, there could be violence against them. So it can put a woman in a very precarious situation, even though obviously in an ideal world, we'd all love to say we can all stand up for ourselves. Unfortunately, it's not always the case. We need an ally and we need advocates around us too.
The other issue that I find with men, especially online, which really irritates me, is the act of, well, we're not all like that. You know, and I sit there, what the hell do you want to say that for? So I understand. Yeah. When you see that, what does that do to you? What do you say? Because I know what it says, but I'm just wondering to hear it from your own voice.
It's a kind of roll your eye moment. You know, you just eye roll at those things because it's sort of like, this isn't about you. And I think that's the fundamental thing, is that when people say that, is it, first of all, you can understand they're getting defensive. And so you have to understand why they're getting defensive. And it means that obviously they're feeling uncomfortable about this situation. So it's a bit like, okay, human nature is coming in right there. But it needs to be like, okay, you're right. Yeah, no, not every man is like this, but you don't need to say that because there's no point. These people basically won't necessarily learn unless their brethren, their brothers basically tell them, yeah, but we're not talking about that. This is a different situation.
Well, I as a man, I think it's a machismo action. I think it's a case of saying, you know, I'm hurt. You know, but I won't show him hurt. So I'll go on the defense and say, well, we're not all like that. But as you said there, it's irrelevant. Whereas actually, if a bloke turns around and said, I'm really confused about this, or maybe they said, I feel uncomfortable, as you said there, that would come across far better. If somebody was to write on Twitter, say, do you know what? As a man, I feel terribly uncomfortable with this. How do I deal with it? And there will be people who will say to them, this is what you should do, or this is what you're doing, and it's great that you're doing that, rather than saying, well, I'm a guy, I look after my daughters, I would never do that to anybody.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you're just stating, as we say in Ireland, you're stating the bleeding obvious, you know, and it's irrelevant, it doesn't add anything to a conversation, and it certainly doesn't take any kind of movement forward.
No, Ken, I agree. And do you know what the worst reaction I find is that whenever there is a murder of a woman or something, usually it's like a male authority or a politician will turn around and said, I have a daughter, or I have a mother, or I have a sister. And it's like, it doesn't matter if you have any of those. The point is that someone has died. And I think that I find a really strange response generally is when people say, yeah, it's because I have a daughter that I care, you know, which is a strange kind of reaction. It's like, it's because I'm a human being, I care.
Yeah. Do you see a future, maybe 50 or 100 years now from here, where women and other minority groups, because they all suffer the same problems that this is, you know, it's just that women is more prominent than most other groups. They're minority groups for a reason. But do you feel that in 50 or 100 years' time, there will be a better place for women in society? Are you confident? Are you optimistic?
I hope so. You know, you get asked this question a lot, but I think the main thing is that you stay hopeful. If you don't stay hopeful, then there is no way you can drive yourself to that change. I remember going to the Women of the World Festival, and the director of the Women of the World Festival in South Bank said, I want everyone to put up their hand to say, do you think things will change? And basically only two people in an entire audience of like 200 people put their hands up. And she said, yes, right there is that is the problem. She said, if you don't hope, then nothing will happen. And I think that's really important to just keep hoping. And very importantly, remember, minorities may be minorities in this country, but they are the global majority.
Absolutely. And I think your podcast, you know, it manages to convey a soft emotional response to this rather than a hard line kind of statement. You know, you never come across as angry, but you always seem to raise these issues with your guests in a way that's insightful and emotional and really touches people on a level, and I really admire you for that.
Thank you, Ken. I really appreciate it. You know, this is the kind of stuff you realize why you're doing it. You know, it's you hope that someone out there just has that kind of glimmer, that glimmer of some level of hope and change for the future. And that's the only reason, you know, sometimes, especially you and I, who are podcasting as a passion, do these things. So absolutely. So thank you, Ken. I really appreciate that.
No, it's true. It's a little lighthouse in the fog of misogynistic, angry, shouting, screaming, what about me-ism, you know? So well done. Keep up the good work. Listen, before I let you go, I have to ask you, because this is really irrelevant to what you do. What are you reading or watching or listening to at the moment?
Well, actually, I've just started reading again The Dip by Seth Godin. I'm not sure if you know Seth Godin.
No, but I'm willing to listen.
he potentially could be a guest on the show, so I'm very excited. He's a very, very well-known face, so I'm very excited for that. but also a book about finance by Simran Kaur. So two very important subjects, especially as the world is changing. The first book being about knowing when to stop, because I think we're always told to go, but we're never told it's okay to stop as well. If something is not working anymore, it's okay to stop. I think that's a really important kind of argument. And the other aspect is obviously women's finances is very different to men's finances. So it's something I just wanted to kind of explore as well. Our peaks are different. So those are the two books I'm currently reading. I'm very excited by it and obviously watch this space. And obviously with TV, I'm very much gearing up for Lord of the Rings next Friday. Super, super excited. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping Amazon does an amazing job of Lord of the Rings, given I loved the books, and I'm hoping they did a very good job with that. And yeah, on TV, you know, I'm on Netflix these days, you know, not so much on terrestrial TV or digital TV anymore, but I just finished watching, and this is a guilty pleasure, of course, which is Never Have I Ever, which is Mindy Kaling's sitcom with a Asian protagonist, young girl. It's quite a special show for other South Asian women, but it has been quite controversial in terms of not every South Asian really relates to it. So very interesting kind of mix of things at the moment.
And any podcasts apart from my own?
Of course yours. Yeah. I there's a few regulars I always listen to, which I really like, which is, first of all, my lovely friend, Kate Hanley's one, which is How to Be a Better Person, which is a lovely, another very lighthearted one, which I really enjoy. There was a couple of new ones that I really thought were absolutely brilliant. Like, it's weird I hadn't sort of come across this before. So there was a few with Brown Girls Read, which is obviously quite similar to what I do. But then there was a few others like Radiolab, you know, which does investigative journalism, Stuff You Should Know, which talks about really random subjects.
Yeah, I like that podcast as well.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so funny. There's a few others like, I really love Song Exploder.
Okay.
Have you ever listened to that?
No, tell me. I'm interested in that now.
It's amazing. So they interview some of the biggest like stars, you know, who've ever lived. So Metallica and
wow.
things like that. Even John Carpenter.
Oh, great.
And yeah, it's really cool. And they talk about their like one particular track that they did. And they said like to really explore that track. Like,
that's a great idea.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
Like, I love that idea.
Isn't it great? It's just so they talk about why they chose to maybe do this riff or how did they change it or maybe it was slightly different before. And I found that so fascinating.
That's brilliant. Just, yeah.
You could
only do that in a podcast, actually.
Yeah.
Crazy. That would be a real Radio 4 program or a podcast.
Yeah,
you know, totally. It's brilliant because actually, I mean, when I interviewed Midjour, that was the kind of tactic I went with. Because, you know, rather than having the machine gun job and trying to get every single thing covered and then suddenly running out of time, I said, no, I'll just focus on one or two things. And one of the things I focused on was what was his favorite Ultravox album. So, yeah,
yes.
It works because you get a more focused podcast, don't you? And that must
That's
be ultra focused. I have to listen to that. What's the name of that again?
Song Exploder. It's so amazing just because as a fellow musician, it really, really blows my mind, especially on specific improv parts.
Why
people choose to do that. I'd love to know about Pink Floyd, for example.
Yeah, I mean, when you're younger, I was younger and I obviously only had vinyl records. So I used to analyze the songs. I would just like, what I used to do was I'd switch off one of the speakers and just have a left speaker or a right speaker and
Ooh.
Focus on the stereo aspect and listen in more, you know, the more intricate bass line because it would be lost within the stereo mix. But when you slap it down and cut it out, I'd say, oh, that's amazing. And I was a musician for myself for years and I used to be focused and fascinated when I'd go into a studio and I'd sit there and listen to my own voice untreated singing in time and I'd be going, that sounds really weird.
So
it's really brilliant to be able to kind of see an album or sorry, come across a podcast where you have that and they're breaking it down like bricks, Lego bricks. I'm looking forward to actually chasing that one up.
Yeah, it's a brilliant definitely. One. I love the episode on John Carpenter's Halloween.
Yeah, I love John Carpenter. He's brilliant.
It was brilliant. Just brilliant.
I mean, what
like,
director
oh
does
God.
His own music and then does something so amazing, you know?
Yeah, and the fact that the director composed it himself, with, yeah. you know, with his band, and then obviously rehashed it for the new version and changed it somehow, which yeah. I was like, yes, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Shashati, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. Can you let me know where can people get in touch, find out what work you do? Give us your website or your links for your podcast.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Ken. So I'm at www.howtobe247.com and you can find me on Apple, Spotify and every other major platform. And please find me at howtobe247 on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. And remember to find me on the YouTube channel for the full interviews. So thank you.
Yeah, brilliant. Lovely having you here. Thanks so much to everybody out there for listening to The Comfortable Spot. My name is Ken Sweeney and I will chat to you again really soon. So take care, y'all. Bye-bye.